Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 29, titled Meeting Vimalakirti.
And I really like it. I was amazed, but I was commissioned to translate this. I was supposed to do the... But the man who commissioned it, being a Chinese scholar and gentleman, he was in love with the Kumarajiva version. But I know that... I knew the Kumarajiva... At that time, I could read Weimojin in Chinese. And I realized that they left out a lot of the things that Sanskrit sutras have. You know, they didn't include to make it more readable in Chinese, sort of formalities and repetitions and things like that. And then I found a second Chinese one later by Xuanzang in the 7th century, which was closer to the Tibetan than Sanskrit. So then I translated from the Tibetan, didn't have the Sanskrit at the time. And then when they assembled a team of 5 Chinese scholars and monks and everybody to it, challenge me, because they're all into the Kumarajiva, I defended myself with the Xuanzang version. And I said, yeah, but Xuanzang says this, you know. And then they let it pass, you know, finally they decided to leave it alone. But I had a long debate of about a month with all these Chinese scholars, and I was not bad in Chinese in those days. I could, I could speak it and read it a bit. Unfortunately, I had a... Well, that's never mind. That's a story. Why I don't remember it so well. Okay, so thus have I heard at one time. And I'm going to do another edition of this, and I might change a few things, you know. But anyway, thus have I heard at one time. It's kind of good, although nowadays I would translate, thus did I hear on a certain occasion, I would translate nowadays. Because what that first phrase, evam maya sutam ekasmin samaye, and what that means is that this sutra was heard by a major disciple of the Buddha who had a photographic memory, and he was there at the original discourses when they put evam maya sutam ekasmin samaye. Now, Western scholars don't believe that. They think that different people just wrote Mahayana sutras and then said Buddha did it, because they don't respect the tradition. You know? But from Buddha's point of view, this was done in Buddha's time. And the one who had a photographic memory is Ananda, one of Buddha's great disciples. You could talk for 2 hours to Ananda and then he could repeat everything you said. He had this kind of amazing gift of memory. The phrase before that is the translator's homage, reverence to all Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, Arya Shravakas, and Pratyeka Buddhas. And those are 2 kinds of Theravada followers in past, present, and future. So they describe these bhikshus, mendicants. By the way, yeah, they call them monks, but they're really not monks in the Western sense. They're mendicants. Bhikshu, the word, is a mendicant. A mendicant is a person who lives on a free lunch. He doesn't ask for dinner or breakfast, just lunch. And people happily give it in Buddhist societies. And so that's the name, bhikshu, who lives on alms, who eats alms, literally. There are 8,000 all saints. They were free from impurities and afflictions and all had attained self-mastery. Their minds, and this is very important because it shows that Mahayana or non-dualist Buddhism completely respects the dualistic Theravada Buddhism, although it refutes its philosophical worldview at a certain stage. But in the meantime, it's a good basis sort of thing for most people, because it is difficult to jump into non-dualism right away. You know, it's kind of too difficult for most people. Although some people intuitively think it's just, of course, correct. You know, But that's sort of the idea of there having to be some sort of different world than the world of where which has produced only suffering to most people who are alert to their sensitivity is a good basis to remove oneself from one's habitual life behaviors and try to transform oneself, to make oneself different. You know? So the sort of idea that cosmically there is this different condition or different state, since one is just thinking of things in terms of states, that's a useful thing. And so the Mahayana was never against the Theravada, actually. And in fact, the number of monasteries in India, after 400 years after Buddha's time, when Buddha predicted India would be ready for the non-dualists, more generally, Mahayana, in other words, and he taught it only kind of esoterically to his followers in his own day, and he said he didn't want it widely spread for 400 years, and after 400 years, it would be widely spread. And after that happened, they built many more monasteries. So the way that modern scholars talk about Mahayana was a rebellion against a bunch of dry monks who were pain and this and that, and they consider Vimalakirti, you know, proves that by Vimalakirti, you know, refuting the views of some of the great monks. But he's only refuting their views, he's completely respecting them as monks, you know. He venerable, he calls them, he honors them, you know. And here he introduces them. You know, their minds were entirely liberated by perfect knowledge. They were calm and dignified like royal elephants. They had accomplished their work, done what they had to do, cast off their burdens, attained their goals, and totally destroyed the bonds of existence. They all had attained the utmost perfection of every form of mind control. So they really calmed down, type of thing. And very cooled out, these monks, you know. Although, actually, that turns out to be a slight drawback, eventually, from the bodhisattva point of view. Although they are wiser than a beginning bodhisattva, the bodhisattva, by cultivating compassion from the beginning, and maybe getting a little more delayed in developing that wisdom, of detached wisdom that the arhats have, or the saints have, but they have this sort of more emotional fire, you could say, in their cultivating of compassionate deeds. So they evolve toward Buddhahood as bodhisattvas more fast. Once the arhats become arhats in a single lifetime, or saints, they're so cooled out, it's like, yeah, I'm compassionate for everybody, but you know, that's like too much trouble. You know, yes, I'm nice, I'll be doing my best for people, but you know, actually, I'm not going to get too hepped up about it. You know, like, I'm going to run for president, you know, sort of thing. You know, the arhat gets like that. So then they don't cultivate the other side, the body of Buddhahood, in a way, you could say. The highly developed relational being that a bodhisattva becomes in order to become a Buddha. Then he goes into the bodhisattvas, which he gives a larger introduction to the 32,000 bodhisattvas. We don't know where they were all sitting. But in other larger sutras, it's very, very sci-fi oriented. Where do all these bodhisattvas come from? They sometimes come from other universes. When a Buddha is teaching or a Buddha is present, they come flying in, you know, in their mental bodies, you know, meditational bodies, you know, subtle bodies, and they sit in space all stacked up in rows like in an amphitheater or something. And in like the Avatamsaka, the Garland Sutra, the Huayanjing, the Avatamsaka Sutra, they describe like some bodhisattva parking attendants. When the bodhisattvas come in from other universes to hear the Buddha teach, they sort of station this one in the north, this one in the northeast, that one in the west, and it's kind of...
Meanwhile, it's kind of these guys are trying to run from Vimalakirti, meanwhile.
No. Oh, yeah, they're not coming to Vimalakirti, they're coming to Buddha here, in the first chapter.
No, but I mean later, because he's...
Well, they're all still scared of him.
Right.
They're not really... Actually, in one of the versions says, in some of the translations, they used to say... I don't want to see Vimalakirti today, they say.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what it says in Sanskrit. It's not utsahami. It says, I'm not enthusiastic to see him, is what they say. In other words, I translate it, I'm reluctant to go see
right.
him. So they're not saying they're not really afraid of him. It's just that every time they've seen him in the past, he's taken them to task for some dualistic idea of some kind of problem that they have, you know. Mm-hmm. And they learn from it, and they say it was really great. I couldn't say anything. I learned this new thing. But you know, I just don't feel like it today. It's like it's like you don't feel like putting your toe, jumping in the cold stream, you know, in the summer, you know. It's going to be a kind of shock, you know.
Yeah.
But then they all rush to see him when Manjushri says, I'll go, I'll talk to him, it's okay. Then they say, oh, let's go hear what Manjushri and Vimalakirti have to say to each other. They say later. So anyway, they say all about the bodhisattvas, which is really nice, you know. All this introduction of the bodhisattvas, and they're, you know, you can't even say they're so amazing. their inexhaustible minds of limitless virtues, and they glorified innumerable Buddha worlds with the splendor of these virtues. They conferred great benefit when seen, heard, or even approached. Were one to extol them for innumerable hundreds of thousands of myriads of aeons, one still could not exhaust their mighty flood of virtues. So, you know, you can read that yourself, so I don't need to read it. So then, Buddha, they present Buddha in the opening setting. And the other thing about it is Buddha is staying with the movie star in her grove and garden. And the locals of the great city of Vaishali, which is like New York, you know, it's like a big financial center at the time. And they are all outraged that he didn't accept their invitation to stay in City Hall or, you know, in some fancy hotel in City Hall. But that's because Buddha had a policy when he would go to a town or a city, the first person who invited him, he would accept their invitation. And she had a better carriage than the city mayor. And she beat them in the race and jumped down from her carriage and said, Your Holiness, to the Shakyamuni, please stay in my garden grove and my servants and everyone. She had a house in the suburbs, you know, in like, you know, like Westchester, you know. And please stay there and then we'll serve you and the 500 monks, you know. So they were outraged, the elder people, and they didn't come to attend him and listen to his teaching. That's why the 500 young people came, the yuppies, their children came. But the older people didn't come. They were like huffed up, you know, oh, he's staying there with the head, like a movie star, you know, Marilyn Monroe. He's out there with Marilyn Monroe. We're not going out there. Him and his 500 monks. So then the young 500 Lichavi youths, each holding a precious parasol made of seven different kinds of jewels, came forth from the city of Vaishali and presented himself at the grove of Amrapali. Each approached the Buddha, bowed at his feet, circumambled him clockwise seven times, laid down his precious parasol and offering it withdrew to one side. And so then, this is the first miracle Buddha does, which is a piece of performance art, I call it, where he takes this step, must have been 500 jewel parasols, must have been quite a pile of jewel parasols. And India, you have to understand, ancient time was the wealthiest place in Eurasia. So it's not unrealistic that there would be huge mountains of jewels there. You know, Maharajas, even after Muslim conquest, they would give away their weight in diamonds and rubies and emeralds and things every year, right, to the populace, just fling it out there. And they were pretty fat, those Maharajas. And that's why Columbus was trying to go there. The Achaemenid Empire from Persia tried to conquer, failing. Alexander the Great tried to conquer it and failed. But then later people did succeed in conquering it, and the Europeans conquered it finally. And then now we have the idea that it's a poor place. But actually it's the best sort of geological environment, the biggest alluvia, river, you know, river basins and things in Eurasia, India. Best climate in the old days. Extraordinary wealthy. And so there they were. Then Buddha makes this thing. When I was translating this, I was astounded. What is this thing? It's a giant precious canopy, so great that it forms a covering for the entire billion world galaxy. And even that's hard to translate. Galaxy, it's a place where there are billion planet Earths. Is what it is, a unit of cosmic dimension where there are a billion worlds, humanoid worlds, actually, according to the ancient Buddhist thing. You know? And they have people coming from these other worlds often, back and forth, by mind travel. So they didn't need Carl Sagan's SETI program. They were already familiar with it. Maybe just by fantasy, I mean, who knows? You know? Anyway, so what kind of surface would such a giant galaxy have? And how could a canopy? And then finally I decided it was a kind of planetarium, like the Haydn Planetarium, or nowadays the Rose Planetarium in New York, you know, like a giant planetarium he created. You know, you look in a planetarium and then you see all kinds of environments and things in it, you know, as well as the stars, you know. They do special shows inside a planetarium. So here they see the interconnectedness of nature, basically. It creates an illusion or a miracle or a piece of performance art, a planetarium, out of all the jewel parasols, where they see their whole world all totally interconnected. They have a temporary precognition of Facebook. They show 1.5 billion or 2 billion. I guess Facebook plus Weibo or whatever the hell they call it, since the communist government insists on making a separate one. So, you know, everyone sort of sees everything as totally interconnected. But within that, of course, they hear the voices of the Buddhas of the Ten Directions. So there's all the Ten Directions Buddhas are on Facebook. They have their Facebook pages. They're making their Facebook statement. Teaching the Dharma. Sounds reverberating the space beneath the great precious canopy. So then they're really thrilled with this, and they feel very happy. And they bow to the Buddha, and they then praise him and then ask him their question. You know? And the praises itself indicates what they later say, these young people, that they're already on the Bodhisattva path, and they already have a lot of knowledge, actually, because the praise is very, Dharma King, you rule with the Dharma, your supreme Dharma kingdom, and thereby bestow the treasures of the Dharma upon all living beings. Expert in the deep analysis of things, you teach their ultimate meaning, that's emptiness, you know, that's interrelatedness, that's relativity. Sovereign Lord of Dharma obeisance to you. All these things arise dependently from causes, yet they are neither existent nor non-existent. In other words, they're not existent as they seem to be, each one being independently, kind of an independent little separate absolute of its own. And they're not non-existent in the sense that they don't exist in that way, but they do exist as relationalities. Therein is neither ego, nor experiencer, nor doer in any intrinsically real way. Yet no action, good or evil, loses its effects within the relativistic network of beings, such as your teaching. So they get the main idea of emptiness and relativity, and they already know that. But, and he goes on, they go on, it's quite a beautiful, I love those verses. But then they say, the praise is nice, and you know you can read it. And then the young, I could talk all day just about any one of these verses, almost, they're so marvelous. You nullify all signs in all things everywhere. You are not subject to any wish for anything at all. The miraculous power of the Buddhas is inconceivable. I bow to you who stand nowhere like infinite space. So right ahead of time, he articulates that they have a very strong idea, at least on some level, of what the Buddha is about and what a Buddha is. Not just a person running around doing something, but some kind of force of understanding and educational presence, let's say. But then they have their question, which is the big question of the Mahayana. They say, Lord, these 500 young Lichavis are truly on their way to unexcelled perfect enlightenment, meaning they already are. That's on the Bodhisattva way. Unexcelled perfect enlightenment is the non-dualist Buddha enlightenment, not the saintly enlightenment alone. And they have asked, what is the Bodhisattva's purification of the Buddha field? Please, Lord, explain to them the Bodhisattva's purification of the Buddha field. And nowadays I translate this term Buddhaverse as opposed to universe or Buddha world, you know, because when we hear field, we think that, well, there's like over in that field there's a Buddha. But it is literally Buddha Kshetra. So if you took field in a larger sense, like an astronomical field or something, it would be all right. But field is too small, really, for what a Buddhaverse is. It's like a whole world in itself, you know, a whole planet. So that's why I like Buddhaverse. It's just a different world, you know? And there's infinite numbers of them. And then they use purification, and that's literally what it says. But I think, in a way, maybe one should translate that as perfection of. In other words, how do you change the world for the better is their question. Because in the non-dualist thing, you see, as you decide to be a bodhisattva, meaning you acknowledge your interconnectedness with other beings as somehow inevitable, you have a hint that past, you actually still have a residue of the human psychosis of thinking that my essence is something separate from everything else and disconnected. It's uniquely me and it's the real me and it's somehow not really connected to everything, which is a subconsciously thinking that. And yet intellectually one can understand, well, actually, really, any place I could go elsewhere from here, which would be another state, there would be a boundary between this state and that state, and it couldn't be the ultimate reality or absolute reality. It couldn't possibly be, because the absolute reality would have no relative boundary. So either if nirvana is real, if it is the reality, as Buddha said, it has to be here, and this has to be happening within it in some way, an illusory way. And you sort of get that mentally, but not viscerally. But by getting it mentally and inferentially, let's say, by reasoning, then one realizes one is interconnected with other beings from the beginning. And therefore one cannot really be totally free of suffering without bringing them all, because one is all of them with you. So that means your job is not just to become enlightened yourself, as if you were something separate from everything else. You have to make the whole world enlightened. All sensitive being. You follow me? And that motivates you to the bodhisattva path. So. But it seems so difficult, because you still subliminally feel, well, I'm a sort of separate. I'm not the building here. I'm not this old beam. I'm not the rotten window over there. I'm not the tree and the grass, and I'm not the other people. You know, I'm really, so how can I change all of that? You know, it seems so massive, you know. And this is the reason that in Mahayana philosophy, there's considered two major branches of non-dualist philosophy, and one is called the mind-only school, which is the main one and the only one really that spread well in China, except for very few people. A little bit in Chan and in the Zhonglun school, but otherwise the main predominant worldview in Mahayana Chinese Buddhism up to now has been this Faxiang, you know, mind-only school. You know, everything is mind. Although that is ultimately critiqued by the Middle Way school, and that was the biggest school in India by far always. But it's considered an essential place to enter into the Mahayana with. Why? Your mind seems like something you can change. All of the concrete seems really hard to change. So if somehow, at some deep level, it's all mind stuff, then you can have an enthusiasm, you can have an ambition. If I can really change my mind, that will change the whole world, if you follow me. But then later it's a little bit critiqued in Madhyamaka, what's called the central way, by saying that, yes, that's so, but it's more convenient to think of mind and our external objects as still somewhat different in a relational way. Not absolutely so, but relatively so. And there's something deeper about that, actually, to like reconstruct the world of others and things and things, rather than, because the danger then of mind only is that, again, one could withdraw into sort of one's own world apart from everything. That's such a powerful human temptation. Because of the fact that our fundamental ignorance, according to Buddha's teaching, is this kind of psychosis. I know it sounds rude, I apologize, but we're all a little psychotic. Meaning, we're in a reality that doesn't exist. We think we are a reality that doesn't exist, which is separate from everything. And this manifests where relationships become very problematical to us. And then if we're greedy, we want to increase that separate thing and have more things connected to it by possessing more things. And if we're paranoid, and then going along with that, we're paranoid that other greedy beings want to absorb us, and so we want to repel them. But they come from that deep subconscious sense of kind of an absolute separateness about it. And then when we get really into delusion, we can become very depressed and feel we're all alone in the universe. And there's no point in even having a body. And then, you know, people commit suicide and so forth. And thinking that they're going into that absolute place. And materialists actually think that the absolute nothingness that is the fundamental nature of the universe, they are going to go there. Yeah, that's psychotic, actually. Our scientists. They think at death, that's their destination. What's that?
No, I'm just thinking.
Oh, you have a question? No. Oh, I thought you thought. What?
They think they go to nothingness.
Yeah, they think that nothingness is something, in other words, a place you can go, which is actually completely insane. You know? If you actually just simply think about it, it's nuts. You know? Everywhere they have law of thermodynamics, no energy can ever be destroyed. The continuum of consciousness is a form, a subtle form of energy. Why is it the one thing that is actually nothing? You follow me? We clearly against that evidence of our common sense that that is not the case. And then they claim that, oh, we know that now. We've disproved all those things about future life. They're all religious superstitions. They will claim that from MIT, Harvard, Columbia. They all claim that they're natural sciences. And then you ask them, and then they say, what proof do you have there's a future life? But you don't have to even say anything. There is a lot of evidence, actually. But you ask them, what evidence do you have that there's nothing? And when will you ever find that and have evidence of that? Who, Carl Sagan, Richard Dawkins are going to report back from nothingness? We're really here, you know? For sure, we're nothing. That'll never happen. So they'll never have evidence for that, actually. So they're basically, it's a superstitious, psychotic idea to think you can be nothing. But, and creates recklessness and irresponsibility like psychotics are, you know, because they think they're not there really doing anything. It's just all some meaningless, random, whatever, you know, and has no meaning, and no consequence, because they're not really there. It is what endangers our planet, actually, this worldview. And ancient time, Hindus, Jains, Buddhists, all agreed in ancient India that whenever materialists would become the major advisors of the kings, you know, where because there were people in those days who had a materialist theory, and whenever they, you know, there's no mind, it's just an illusion, eat, drink, and be merry, some of them. Then others were big ascetics, you know, just starve to death because it's too boring to hang around. And whenever they became, if they ever dominated the advisory, you know, the ministerial advisory capacity of any kingdom, then that kingdom would go to ruin, they said. They always said. And it makes sense, because the people living there would be just grab whatever it is in front of them, because it all would have no ultimate meaning or consequence to them. Worst that can happen to you is nothing. In other words. So those people like Sam Harris and others who scream and shout about how horrible religions have been causing people to do this and that, and they talk ISIS, oh, look at those fanatics, or there are plenty of Christian fanatics and Jewish fanatics and Hindu fanatics, and there's even Buddhist fanatics, and they all go nuts, but very few relatively are Buddhists, because God is not there to help them out being fanatical, but usually. But the point is that they shout and scream about that, and they don't notice about Stalin and Hitler and Mao. These guys didn't believe in God. They were not religious. But they believed they wouldn't have any consequence from all the people they killed. And they killed a lot of people and destroyed a lot of stuff. So they're being naive, actually, a little bit. Anyway. So this is the question. How do you change the world? Then Buddha... And this is why we do this in relation to hiking. Because the idea is when you get to the top of the mountain... And you look out and see the Buddha land, and you see the interconnection of everything in the green ocean that you see from the top of the hill there. You see the little island down here. This is our little Buddha, our little kind of Buddha base here. But the Buddha land, you just look out over the mountains. It's marvelous. And meditate on that, you know. The interconnection, you know, to see the sacred, the great canopy that Buddha made, the jewel canopy, in which everything is all interconnected. And that means that if you have a good vibe in your mind, you send that out to all the presidential candidates, the nice ones will be inspired. So Buddha says, okay, that's a great question. Your question to the Tathagata about the purification of the Buddha. By the way, what do you think of the translation for Tathagata of the thus gone one? What does that mean to you? Can anyone tell me?
But it means that he's...
What?
He's not here and here. I thought it means that he's not here, but he's here.
Well, that's pretty good. That's good. That's good.
Somebody told me that.
But that's right. Or rather, that here to a Buddha is such. You know? And such means that it's sort of here, but not here, in a way. Because it means, you know, such as something means it's not itself something. Sometimes, and that means somehow that there's an ultimate dimension to it, that it's not whatever it appears to be, you know, in that way. Then there is something called thatness, which would be tatgata, not tatagata. And that's thatness or itness, you know. And that means that the absolute is in every little detail here. You know? So there's, the non-duality can be thought of in two dualistic ways. But anyway, thus gone, well, you've learned that then. But by itself, if you ran into thus gone, would it really connote that to you? What would it mean? Has anybody got any suggestions? I think finally I'm going back to just saying Tathagata and let people learn that name. But maybe I'm copying out. I used to say realized one. Because also the word gata, in English, understanding, because of the authoritarian nature of European societies, when you have a knowledge of something, you stand under it. Meaning, it relates a little bit to authority and obedience. Do you follow me? It's just because, you know, the idea in authoritarian society is you can't understand anything, so you just have to obey whatever people say it is. Some high authority, God or the priest or the king. You just have to understand, stand under whatever they say. Whereas in Sanskrit, when your mind comes to, opens itself to a new way of seeing, then you go into a different place. So the words for deep understanding are with from the verb to go, gam, you know. So tathagata, adigama, you know, there's these, they're variations of the word to go. It's like when you have a new understanding of something, then you're in a different world. You've gone into a different world. You're in a different place, if you follow me. Which I think is kind of fun. I like that. It's a little more emphasizing human ability, actually, than we're used to in the West, where we're taught that we really don't have the ability to understand. If someone says, oh, I understand everything, they're given like Librium or something, Prozac. Oh, that you must be crazy because nobody can understand everything, is the idea, you see. Even we have some Buddhist guys going around going, don't know anything, now I'm enlightened. That means I'm enlightened because I don't know anything anymore. I love that. They go around with it, mind is not knowing, and that's enlightenment. Okay, so Tathagata. So question Tathagata about the purification of the Buddha field, purification meaning perfection of the Buddhaverse, Buddha world, is indeed good. Therefore, young man, listen well and remember, I will explain to you the purification of the Buddha field of the Bodhisattvas. Very good Lord, replied Ratnakara, which means jewel mine, and the 500 young Lichavis, and they set themselves to listen. So, and now here, this is great. Noble sons, although when I retranslate this, I'm going to say noble heirs, because in Sanskrit, which is an inflected language with masculine, feminine, and neuter cases, there is a grammatical rule that the male incorporates the female. Like, you know, man, you know, this whole thing between chauvinist language and non-sexist language. Human, you know, or it's the humankind, you know, instead of saying, you're supposed to say mankind, and that's supposed to include women. But I don't like that. I would say humankind or human. But otherwise, son really is son, you know. Son does not include daughters. So this, but in Sanskrit it does, putra, you know. There is duhita, but putra by itself in Sanskrit includes either male or female. And I didn't follow that when I did this, so I should do that. I'm going to change it when I re-edit it. I'm going to say noble youths or noble heirs or something like that rather than noble sons, something that can be gender neutral.
Why wouldn't you use sons and daughters?
I'm sorry?
Why wouldn't you use just sons and daughters?
Well, because then you're adding another word, uh-huh. And there is only the one word. So translators really hate to add extra syllables and words.
But I've been saying, I'm not going to deride men and women, and I found that was very useful.
Well, yeah, that's okay if you're doing something that's freely writing. And I do that sometimes, he and she or she and he, but it's very awkward. And if you want people to remember, it's better to have a single word. And the word heir is perfectly good. Or a child. Or a youth. Those are all fine, in my view. Mm-hmm. You don't have to, you know, elaborate. And actually, then you'd miss. Because, for example, in the Heart Sutra, Shariputra, the monk, says, when a noble son wants to do this or that, and he uses just the masculine, and then Avalokiteshvara answers him and said, when any noble son or noble daughter, he actually says that then. So if you put that son and daughter everywhere, then you would miss that particular thing, for example. You follow me? So that's the reason why a translator would not want to do that. Mm-hmm. The difference between writing something and then translating it. And, you know, that's what I was trying to say about the Chinese translations. If instead of going to make a special language that then created a subculture in Chinese civilization, the Buddhist subculture, they had persisted in using the same words that the Taoists and the Confucians used, sometimes altering with a special word. Like sometimes they use Tao for Dharma, which they still do even after they made a special thing. And then they use Fa, which means like law for Dharma also. And but, you know, in an American dictionary or English dictionary or any European dictionary, and nowadays probably in Chinese one, I don't know modern Chinese ones now, they have meaning 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know. Some are archaic. Some are meanings in different contexts of the same word, you know. So eventually you would have had a dictionary where you would have had Tao in Taoism meaning, and then Tao in Buddhism meaning Fa, meaning Dharma, and then there would be that right in the dictionary, and yet the word would be familiar sounding to the Chinese reader, and then it would not be so easy to make a subculture out of it. You see, that then some Confucian scholar or reader of ancient classics and history would say, oh, I don't read that stuff, because it's some other language that I don't like. And Xuanzang in particular, he translated more Buddhist technical writings, not just sutras, and then he made terminology that was just a little bit difficult for Chinese intellectuals. But now, probably not so bad, but it's an undiscovered country, the whole thing. We'll see what happens. Okay, so then they said, so this is a very powerful statement. Noble heirs, or noble youths, a Buddha field of bodhisattvas is a field of living beings. So the universe is not a bunch of rocks and stones and round planets and things like that primarily. It's actually interwoven mind stuff of beings. He's pushing in that direction. And by living beings, he doesn't just mean humans. Gods, Buddhists never rejected that there are gods. They reject that there's one creator god who is to be blamed for the whole thing or credited for it. That they reject. And they even have God himself rejecting that he did that. Brahma, the creator, who the Indians think of as creator at this time, he says, I didn't really do it. Don't blame me. Said, I did my best, but I'm not the... There is no one single creator, you know, mind. But Buddha's not one, and there isn't one. But there are plenty of gods. So they are powerful, and they are demons, very powerful ones. And so it's a minefield of all these beings, rather than some sort of mind and matter, or like a bunch of junk, you know, universe. So a bodhisattva embraces the Buddha field to the same extent that he causes the development of living beings. So by changing the beings, starting with yourself, that's how you change the universe. He embraces the Buddha field to the same extent that living beings become disciplined, and that word dulwa literally means tamed, which I was translating disciplined there. I might go back to tamed if I read it. I might say educated now. He embraces a Buddha field to the same Buddhaverse to the same degree that through entrance into a Buddhaverse, living beings are introduced to the Buddha intuition. I don't like gnosis anymore. I would definitely translate gnosis nowadays as intuition, the Buddha intuition. He embraces the Buddha field to the same extent that through entrance into that Buddha field, living beings increase their holy spiritual faculties, which are fivefold, you know, faith, concentration, wisdom, discernment, this kind of thing. Why so? Noble son, noble child, a Buddha field, a Buddhaverse of bodhisattvas springs from the aims of living beings. Then he deconstructs the entire thing. He says, for example, Ratnakara, should one wish to build in empty space, one might go ahead in spite of the fact that it is not possible to build or to adorn anything in empty space. In just the same way, should a bodhisattva who knows full well that all things are like empty space, wish to build a Buddha world in order to develop living beings, he might go ahead in spite of the fact that it is not possible to build or to adorn a Buddhaverse, Buddha world in empty space. So he sort of creates a deconstruction of the whole task right then and there, the same moment that he introduces it, which is really cool, actually. And that means sort of don't get all like attached to like, oh, I'm going to do this perfect thing. You know, you realize in a way it's impossible. In a way other Buddhas have already done it. It gives you a little bit of relaxation to deconstruct it at the same time as you have ambitions for it. And he doesn't say you shouldn't do it. In a way, he says, goes ahead and does it even though knowing that it's impossible. I love that, actually. Actually, it's in my horoscope, my Western horoscope. My day of birth is called the day of the impossible quest. Oh, no, dangerous, that's right, the day of the dangerous quest.
Uh-huh.
And it says, I only like to do things that are impossible. Really, total Western thing, nothing but it's about it. Do you know that? Do you know that book, The Magic Language of Birthdays? By Brett Schneider and Elfers. Goldschneider and Elfers. Oh, it's a great book. Do any of you know that book? You should look up your own date, but beware. You'll get good advice. It's a great book. It really is. You can find it online, actually, just to look up your own date. You don't have to buy it. Then he goes on all this stuff about where all these great qualities that people have, you know, positive mind, morality, tolerance, effort, creative effort, meditation or concentration, wisdom, the four immeasurables, love, compassion, joy, and impartiality, the four social graces, I would call them nowadays, he says here, means of unification, I wrote in those days. All liberative arts and activities will be born in his Buddha field. And here you want to say his or her, you know, when you have that particle. But actually there is a convention that you can say there. You know, you can pluralize it and then it becomes gender neutral. That's easier than two words, you know. Anyway, so 37 leads to enlightenment, etc. All this incredible stuff. And finally he says, his virtuous application is tantamount to his high resolve. That means we're really motivated, dedicated at work. His high resolve is tantamount to their determination. Their determination is tantamount to their practice. Their practice is tantamount to their total dedication. Their total dedication is tantamount to their liberative technique, or liberative art, I would say nowadays. Their liberative art is tantamount to their development of living beings. And their development of living beings is tantamount to the purity of their Buddha fields. The purity of their Buddha field reflects the purity of living beings. Purity of living beings reflects the purity of their intuition. The purity of their intuition reflects the purity of the teaching. The purity of the teaching reflects the purity of their transcendental practice. And the purity of their transcendental practice reflects the purity of their own minds. So then that miracle, he does the miracle where, right? You know that, where Shariputra says, how can he be Buddha? What kind of impure guy is he, Shakyamuni, when the world looks so terrible? It's not pure, and so his mind must have been really impure. And then he teases him, right? Then he puts his toe down, and everybody sees everything as perfect Buddha field. So that's the challenge, you know. That means that Shakyamuni Buddha, and actually timeless Buddhas, have already made this world into the perfect one for us to evolve positively in. That's the vision they all have. So we can't excuse ourselves by saying, well, I have to like work on my job, I have to do this, I have to do that. I can't put all my effort toward enlightenment because I've got to compromise in all these ways because it's just a bad circumstance. I'm not living in Shakyamuni's monastery or something. But actually, we are living in Shakyamuni's Buddha world. That's the Vimalakirti message, you know. Because when he puts his toe on the ground, he temporarily gives a revelation to people that everything is cool. Actually, I love Reverend Michael Beckwith. Michael Bernard Beckwith. Did you ever hear of him? Mm-hmm. I love that guy. I only met him, I met him a bunch of times, actually. But I only met him in a really more dialogue context where we had a... Because I heard when he gave a sermon and then he asked me to give a talk too... And his sermon was entitled, All Right Already. Nice. And based on the Jesus sayings in Matthew and so on, he was saying that the thing is, you're already saved if you understand, you know. Because it isn't like later after death or being this and that. But you mustn't misunderstand that then you can do anything you want and you will be. But he's saying you get a vision that everything already is perfect. that the divine has come down and enfolded the world in this thing, so that the suffering is just based on some mistaken view, wrong vision. You know? So he took it in a completely, and that's exactly the same thing as Buddha putting his toe on the ground. You know, and I love that sermon. All right, already it was. And then I gave, in parallel to that, what I call my consolation prize. Do you all know my consolation prize? You've all been here. Do you know it? Laura knows it.
Yes, I
think. Kim knows it.
Yeah.
Do you know it, Linghua? What I call my consolation prize. Do you remember it, Mitchell?
No.
My consolation prize, which usually I wait at the end of some event, but I will tell you again, I will go back to it maybe, is what I offer to myself for failing to be enlightened. After 51 years of intensive study, not so intensive all the time, but fairly hard study, I offer myself this consolation, which is, although I'm not enlightened, I know enough about it to be convinced that I will become enlightened. Because, you know, it's like falling off a log, actually, if you really get a view of what the world is and the skill in liberative art of all enlightened beings, of which there are infinite numbers. Even though one of oneself is infinitely dense, but still there's multiple infinities against one's own dumb infinity, so they'll overwhelm us. So I know I will be enlightened. And then I came to understand that enlightenment, nirvana, when you attain nirvana, you only do so by realizing you've always been in nirvana. Because it's like the kind of thing when you come to know it, you realize you always did, but you weren't paying attention to that deeper knowledge that you had of whatever it is. You were somehow distracted on some other plane of thinking this was what was real and that. But we are as underlying, you actually were there without realizing that you were there because of ignorance. So, but when you get there, whenever it is, you then revise all of your past experience. Even death, even sojourns in hell, even living as a cockroach or a crocodile or a mosquito, whatever it is, you realize that was all just some sort of play on the surface, infinite surface of nirvana, clear light of the void, you know, clear light of bliss. So that means that's my consolation. I have a headache, I have a toothache, I'm just recovering from the flu, I'm tired, my voice is like that. And that's why I think there are a lot of imperfections around, you know, things that are problematic. But later, whenever it is, doesn't matter, it can be a thousand lifetimes later, when I do attain nirvana, I'll realize, this is great. This is nirvana now. It's just I don't know it now. But I will. That's the consolation prize. So that's the all right already. Same idea. Then I told that to Michael Beckwith in that particular Sunday that I was there. And he really liked it. We became fast friends. His all right already. And consolation prize, you know, the fact that the Buddha's existed, past, present, and future. It's called Triadvanya. They intuit all three times as infinitely present, you know, eternally present.